Tuesday, April 14th, 2007. Open a public hearing on House Bill 5002 and a public hearing on House Bill 5003. And I think we were in about the third policy option packet.
Page 51 of 207. Good morning, Mr. Chair and members. For the record, Katie Koba, Department of Agriculture. We were on package 204. Any idea how I should bump to renewable energy now?
Sure.
Okay. What I'd like to do, because we have Carol Mallory Smith with us this morning from Oregon State University, I would like to move to package 401, which is on page 60 of 207. And this is a package that is tied to our biodiesel efforts in the state, and basically what has developed over the last couple of years is the fact that canola is considered the best feedstock for biodiesel that can be grown in Oregon. The problem with canola being produced in the Willamette Valley is that it can cause some challenges for especially seed production, which is very successful here in the Willamette Valley. So as this issue began to develop and the industry began to talk to figure out a way to resolve it, the department put in place a protected district that includes the whole Willamette Valley, where canola right now could only be grown based on a special permit that's approved by the department. And what we have done is, working with Oregon State University, set up a research project which was funded last fall from the Emergency Board to look at more of the economics around canola, some of the problems that the specialty seed industry is concerned about, particularly with weediness, cross-pollination, some of those kinds of things, how to keep purity in specialty seeds, as well as beginning research on potential alternatives to canola as a feedstock for biodiesel. So this package would continue that research effort into 0709, and Carol is here this morning to give just a brief update on what has happened so far with the research and maybe talk a little bit about what OSU is thinking about going into next biennium.
Carol Mallory Smith, Oregon State University. I'm an associate department head for the Department of Crop and Soil Science, and I am a weed scientist, so that's my area of expertise. Dr. Carroll is out of the country, so could not be here to give this presentation. As Katie said, there were quite a few questions that were raised about the introduction of canola into the Willamette Valley, and so the research that we put together was really to address, can canola be grown here effectively? Can production, can we get good production out of canola? And then can we work with the specialty seed industry in a way that we don't threaten their industry and other growers can grow canola for biodiesel production? And is canola the best crop for biodiesel in the Willamette Valley? So last fall we established research fields. Five research fields were planted in the Willamette Valley where we could go into those fields, look at yield production, look at yield practices, to see if we could increase yield in some of those areas. We also have some laid over the top of those fields some other research projects. One of them is looking at fertility. Another's doing some herbicide trials to see if we can control weeds that would come up in canola. We will also be looking at ways of controlling volunteer canola in the future, because next year when you take these fields out, there's going to be canola seeds left there. So we're looking at ways of controlling volunteer canola. And one of the reasons that we really want to be able to do that is to make sure that we aren't, again, causing issues for the special seed crop industry. So we want to be able to control any plants that would come up next year. So we have those fields established. We also put in a small gene flow research project in one of the fields where we put broccoli plants within the field, which would be the same as what the specialty seed crop growers are growing, looking for cross-pollination and to see, does it really happen under field conditions? Do you really get outcrossing and cross-pollination. So those field studies are established. We've also got some small research plots looking at alternatives to canola. There's several crops, including sunflower and safflower, camelina, that might possibly be substitutes for canola, and those particular crops would not raise the issues with the specialty seed crop growers that canola does. So we've also got those projects ongoing. Some of the other projects that we've been looking at are economic analysis. So we have people that are working on economic analysis of canola production for biodiesel and also production of some of these other crops for biodiesel. They're working on budgets for feasibility for producing biodiesel on farm and also for larger production, commercial production. We've developed a website where we've been able to put some of the information, and as data becomes available, we will be posting data on that website so that it's out there for everybody to see wherever you fall on and what side of the issue you fall on. You can see what the data says. We've also been working on a climatic mapping of the area so that we could actually be able to predict where the best places for producing canola might be in the Willamette Valley, and also areas which are more appropriate for specialty seed production versus some of the larger seed larger areas where we might be growing grass seed or some of these other crops. So we're trying to really determine where's the best place to maybe be able to put in these controls where you say, yes, you can grow canola here, but we're going to grow specialty seed crops in this area. And also, I think the last project that I'll mention is a pinning map. In the past, when these seed growers have grown these specialty seed crops, and they've looked at how do we isolate and not have this cross-contamination issue that they've talked about between different crops, they actually go into the extension offices, and on the wall there's a map, and it's called a pinning map, and they take these different colored pins, and they put it on this map. And then the next person that comes in knows, okay, that's where there's a field growing and I need to be this far away from it. And that's how it's been done in the past. So now we're putting together a computer program which will have more accuracy and more historical record for saying, okay, this was done here last year, so there could be issues here this year. So we've been working with the specialty seed groups on actually producing something that they think is going to be valuable. We've met with representatives of the specialty seed group. They were out with us last week, looked at fields. They were on campus last week looking at what we're doing to develop this pinning map for them. And we've been working with them, bringing them into the research that's going on so that we have everybody knowing what's going on. They've been providing plant material for us to put in the field for these outcrossing studies and things like that. So we've had a lot of conversations with them. I think there's a little bit more comfort within the whole industry now than there was probably a year ago. So if you have any questions about what we're doing.
Number one, is it true that canola uses less water, irrigation water?
Than specialty seed?
Than grass seed or?
No, I don't think that's probably true. I mean, I don't have the numbers for that, but, you know, we're not irrigating grass seed production for the most part, and we wouldn't be irrigating canola for the most part either.
Follow?
In the Willamette Valley.
And that leads to my next question, in that I know we have about 20,000 acres that are going into canola in the Klamath Basin, and one of the keys that we keep hearing is the fact that it will take less irrigation water. And that's what I was trying to get to as to...
It's probably true it would take less irrigation water than something like potatoes or other things that they could be growing there. So, yes, I would say that would be
true. And second question, Mr. Chair. When you talk about the cross-contamination, does that hold true not only for grass seed, but let's say potatoes or wheat or whatever?
No. The question of cross-contamination between canola and the specialty seed crops is specific because canola is a brassica species, and the crops, specialty seed crops, many of the vegetable seed crops that they're growing are also brassicas. So canola is related to broccoli and cabbage and bok choy, you know, this whole long list of relatives. And in some cases, they actually will produce hybrids between the two, or just having the seed as a contaminant in the vegetable seed would be considered a contaminant that could cause export issues.
Thank you.
Thank you. Just two questions, one on yields in the Willamette Valley and rotations. How long do you have to wait between you can grow it back to better?
Yields we think could range anywhere from 1,500 pounds to 3,500 to 4,000 pounds, and a lot of that is sort of what brought this research about because we didn't have good numbers on that. I think those numbers are still out there and people are still making a lot of educated guesses about them. Rotations, the way that most people think, at least initially, it would be used would be in rotation with grass seed, and so it would probably be planted every 4 to 5 years. And there's also, in some areas where it is grown, there are actually restrictions on how often you could actually grow canola on a field, and that goes back to disease pressures. So we want to make sure that rotations are long enough out there and that you're not getting a disease buildup, because the diseases of canola would be diseases of the specialty seed crops.
I guess my point is that, you know, if we were going to develop this huge canola industry in Oregon, you need one every 4 years, you're actually going to have to do it. I've heard that you would need like 250,000 acres to create a plant. And so therefore, you'd actually need 1 million acres, because you're not supposed to plant this stuff once every 4 years. And there's only 1 million acres of wheat, 1 million acres of alfalfa, and unless we have water, well, I'm going to get my water in here. So. And help those poor farmers out in eastern Oregon.
I have a question regarding what is the process going to be as far as how long will you be researching this before the department says, okay, we have enough information, we have, you know, 2 years, 3 years of consistent information that they can make a decision about these control districts?
Well, that's a really good question, and of course as a researcher you're always going, you know, it's going to be 20 years before I can give you the answer. But what we're projecting is that, you know, the way that the research was set up initially was a three-year project, and hopefully by the end of that 3 years we'll have some really strong data that says, yes, canola is a viable crop or not a viable crop in the Willamette Valley just based on yields. And then secondly, in that time frame, hopefully we'll be able to really answer some of these questions that the specialty seed growers have raised about, are there issues of hybridization? And some of this work we'll be doing in the greenhouse just to answer those questions. Are those real questions? Are those real, or are they just, you know, things that people think would happen? We'll be looking at volunteers during that time. So next year we'll be back on the same fields to see, you know, how much canola comes back. So we're thinking a three-year project, and I think the original budget we had put in was for a three-year project, thinking that at the end of 3 years there'll still be unanswered questions, but hopefully that the director will have all of the information that she would need to at least make a decision about that.
And the second part of the question, if I may, Mr. Chair, is, so how is this research being funded? I mean, do you have a research fund that you allocate to OSU, or is it something that you have some flexibility in your ability to decide which research projects, you know, you focus on the university and is able to do? I'm just curious, because I have to say the department, to their credit, responded very quickly to this issue and was able to, I mean, within a year, get this research set up. So,
Mr. Chair, Representative Dingfelder, we do not have a research fund in the agency, so we came to the emergency board and received funding last fall, and then this package would continue the research effort.
And then that
we contract specifically
with
OSU to do that work.
And I'd just like to add to that is that, you know, this money that did come to OSU, there's a lot of effort there that goes beyond this. And I think this gave us sort of the start to be able to do a lot of things, but there are a lot, if you look at the number of researchers that are involved with this now across all disciplines, you know, the effort goes way beyond even what this funding is.
I had one question, and it's to Ms. Kova. Where is this? Just curious. Where is your statutory authority to limit what crops an individual farmer can grow?
I know we have it, Mr. Chair. I'm going to see if somebody in the room knows the exact number.
I've seen it, so.
I'm guessing 561 something.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, or at 561, and it allows us to establish control districts to deal with pests, diseases, things like that.
So, in other words, for a common benefit, we have a law that in effect actually limits someone's use of their property.
Mr. Chairman, we do, and we also have a bill that would clearly exempt our authority around control districts, quarantines, embargoes, et cetera, from Measure 37 claims because we are worried about that potential, and the Attorney General is not clear if this would quarantines, embargoes, et cetera, would qualify under the public health provision exemption of Measure 37. We tried to get it through last session, and we didn't quite get there. We're going to try it again this session.
Thank you. Thank you both. And we'll go on to the next policy option package. And
just keep waiting until you get a number.
Yeah.
And, Mr. Chair, I might add for this package, we had also requested as part of the package an FTE in the agency that would be a full-time person to work on renewable energy. For those of you who have worked with our agency on this topic, the magic man, Brent Searle, who seems to catch everything in the agency, has really been picking up the renewable energy efforts in addition to his other work. We've gotten to the point now where we really need a full-time person dedicated to that. There was an error in the governor's recommended budget. He intended to include that position in this package and did not. So we are asking for the FTE to be included in the package, and then we are going to work with the budget that was given in this package to fund the position within the existing resources. So we won't ask for additional money, but we would like the FTE authority.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you, Carol.
So we'll move back then to package 204, which is on page 51. And this is a package for a position in our measurement standards division. This was a very small program that we have where we do checking in stores to ensure package products weight. Probably the best known example where we had a recent problem with this issue was in a grocery store that you all know where you package ground beef, for example, and there is oftentimes a piece of paper, a couple pieces of paper that are put in the packaging to soak up juice. Stores are supposed to put a tear weight adjustment on their packaging in order to account for that, and that was not happening. So this is a program that is basically doing spot audit checks on stores to make sure their packaging and package weight is accurate. The funding was discontinued during this special session budget cuts. During the last legislative session, it was actually Senator Bates that was on the Natural Resources Subcommittee that had some real interest in this, and we received about $50,000, I'm remembering, Paul, in general fund to do some audit work. In this current biennium, we have done that, and we have come back and then requested a full-time position to continue that work from this point forward. So that is what this package would do, $190,000 in general fund in one position.
I had one question regarding this, and that is, I think your example that was given is actually, in essence, a local entity that's actually repackaging goods. Does the federal government, in terms of the FDA, in normal packaging of goods, allow some range in terms of what's reflected on the package in terms of the contents?
For the record, Lisa Hansen with the Department of Ag. FDA does not regulate the contents. It's actually through the National Institute of Trade and Standards and Trades, NIST. And there are tolerances that are allowed, but the different package types have to fall within those tolerances. And in the case that Director Koba mentioned, the situation was they were actually not taking the appropriate tear on these repackaged products.
Okay. But in essence, if we found something on that was on a store shelf and was packaged by someone out of state and it was outside these ranges, what would our remedy be for addressing that?
Mr. Chair, checking with the expert behind me, we can actually embargo those materials and have them taken off sale.
Any additional questions? Seeing none, we'll go to this quick work session.
Now that Representative Clinton's here.
I will close the hearings on House Bill 502 and House Bill 503. Open a hearing and a work session on SB, or I'll open a hearing on SB 100 and open a work session as soon as you explain it.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, Senate Bill 100 is the bill that you heard last week in your committee to place an Oregon State Fair account within the State Parks and Recreation Department fund. It's a housekeeping measure, has no fiscal, and it's here today for you to act upon.
Okay. Any discussion? Okay. I will open a work session. Is that? Yes.
So, Mr. Chair, I move
SB 100.
SB 100, an auspicious number, to the full Ways and Means with a due pass recommendation.
Okay. It's been moved to move SB 100. SB 100 to the full committee with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Any objections? Seeing no objection, motion passes. Representative Garrard, will you carry to the full and to the House?
I will, with Director Koba's approval.
And I will carry to the Senate.
Thank you.
And now, close that work session. Open a hearing on reopen a hearing on House Bill 5002 and House Bill 5003. That was a long break.
That was a long break. Mr. Chair, members, Katie Koba, Department of Agriculture. We are now on to Package 300. On page 52, this is the third of our fee increases, and the good news here, Representative Garrard, is this is a small fee increase. One of the programs where we are getting into the mode of doing more regular, smaller fee increases, this would raise the cap in the statute for the pesticide program, and we would expect sometime during the course of the coming biennium to bump up the fees then through administrative rule. We have been working with the industry on this. They are aware of it and supportive, and we expect the other funds limitation that we need at $412,000. Moving on to Package 306. The Eastern Oregon entomologist position is a position that we've had in our agency for a long time. Sometime 2-3 years ago, this position, the entomologist in the position retired. He continued on working for us as a volunteer, but the position came up as vacant in the PICS list, and so the position was inadvertently taken from the agency. It is a position that we need. It does our work on the east side of the state, primarily grasshoppers, but has also been involved in other pest control issues. So we were asking that this position be reinstated and funded with general fund, which it was before it got taken.
Yes.
Members of the committee, just to clarify, the position actually still exists. It's funded with federal funds, and there's no federal revenue to support the position. So during the downturn, instead of eliminating the position, the department was able to keep the position and look for federal funds, which they were unable to find, but it kept the position on the books. And now they're coming back to ask for general funds to replace the federal funds.
Correct. Thanks, Paul. I'll ask question for Representative Burley, since he's not here, since we've discussed this item. Is there any possibility that the work that you can be need to have done can be done either through cooperation with federal agencies, who probably have people on staff with this background, or through the university system?
Mr. Chair, I'll take an initial stab at the question and then let Lisa add if she needs to. This is actually part of our plant program, our integrated pest control disease program. We have a number of folks on staff that do our survey work for all of our pests. We have staff members that are entomologists, and actually the federal government contracts with us to carry out pest trapping and pest control and eradication efforts in the state. So if we do have an incident like the gypsy moth outbreak in Bend, then the feds send us federal funds to do the eradication work. So it really is appropriately housed in our agency. It's part of our plant division and the program that we carry out.
Any additional questions? Okay, we can go on.
Okay. Package 307, State Invasive Species Coordinator. We talked about the Invasive Species Council yesterday. It was established by the 2001 legislature. In that statute, it also, we actually have the language here on the package, subject to available funding, the Invasive Species Council may appoint a State Invasive Species Coordinator to, in essence, staff the Invasive Species Council. We've never had the funding to do that. This is a package that would request funding to staff a State Invasive Species Coordinator. We tried to be creative in putting this funding together, requesting one-third general fund, one-third other funds, one-third federal funds. Our goal was to begin staffing the position with general funds, and part of the staff responsibility then would be to identify additional funds, whether they're federal funds that we could go after in the form of a grant, or other funds from partners, whether that be state agencies, private nonprofits, maybe the Nature Conservancy, for example, would be an entity that would want to help fund this position. But we kind of felt we needed the general fund component to get the effort up and running and see what kind of additional resources we could bring in to fund this position. Yes.
Regarding the, now I see in your budget that there's a request for Measure 66 money, the noxious weed control. So can you explain, because I know this is the Invasive Species Council, so just clarify what's the relationship and what that money is going to be used for versus what this policy option package does.
Mr. Chair, Representative Dingfelder, I look at this, the State Invasive Species Council is kind of the overarching council. So weeds are a subset of invasive species, but so are diseases and so are other pests. So the Invasive Species Council is the one that creates the top 100 bad pests. It's a multi-agency, multi-entity council. The weed board, which is in our agency, actually takes the weed funds that we have and grants out projects for actually doing weed work on the ground. So then that information that we get out of that effort would feed into the Invasive Species Council to see if it's still, you know, an existing invasive species or is being eradicated and that kind of thing.
That makes sense. Yes. Who's eligible for those grants? Is it private, public?
Mr. Chair, Representative Dingfelder, everybody. Short answer. I don't know if Lisa wants to expand on that.
Mr. Chair, Representative Dingfelder, the weed grants are available to private, public, anybody. We have a state weed board, excuse me, that actually evaluates all of the grants that come in, and then they prioritize them depending on the impacts of them.
And just a final question on that, as far as coordination with OWEB, because, for instance, you know, there could be watershed that's being targeted and they're doing riparian work on other knotweed or blackberry or whatever eradication. So a landowner working with a watershed council could then apply to this fund. Because I'm just trying to make
yes.
you know, understand
Chair.
That there's not duplication,
yes.
and because we have the whole grant program and
exactly.
OWEB and all
Mr.
their
Chair,
criteria.
Representative Dingfelder, based on our conversation yesterday, we thought it would be very helpful to have Tim Butler, who runs our weed program in the Department of Ag, come today in case there were further questions, and I'd really like to let him explain how well we coordinate with the world.
Great.
Please proceed.
Thank you very much. For the record, again, I'm Tim Butler. I manage the noxious weed control program at the Department of Agriculture. And I guess to answer, Mr. Chair, Representative Dingfelder, to answer your question, we are coordinating activities with OWEB, we are continuing to try to strengthen that to ensure that we're working together on getting the highest priority weeds that are taken care of and working on a watershed approach as far as dealing with noxious weeds statewide. And that's certainly a priority, and we have a ways to go there, I think, as far as bridging that gap with working together with OWEB, and we're working very closely with other land management agencies around the state. Work very closely with U.S. Forest Service, Bureau of Land Management, as far as our federal partners, and there's a lot of good cooperative efforts that are going on as far as weed control efforts on a statewide basis. So I think that the POC that we have in, I think, is to try to strengthen that effort and to take that forward so we can do additional work as far as protecting our natural resources and agricultural resources from invasive noxious weeds.
Okay. And that has that full-time position that does the grant administration and oversight. Is that correct? And
just for committee's sake, we're kind of referencing package 312
right.
On page 57.
I'm sort of jumping ahead, but
it's okay. We might as
it's sort of somewhat connected because one's a subset of the other is the way I look at it. So okay, so that is one FTE, and that's a new grant program, or it's existing and hasn't been staffed?
Mr. Chair, Representative Dingfelder, the grant program has been in effect since the 9901 biennium when the legislature appropriated funding for that. And you are correct, there was not a position that was allocated to help to coordinate that and to do the monitoring and tracking that we really would like to do. At that time, we did that with existing staff, and I feel very good about what we've accomplished to this point. But it is imperative that we're able in order to do the job that we would like to do, I think that it's imperative to have a position that is dedicated towards ensuring that we're getting the monitoring and the tracking of those dollars and to document the successes that we're achieving with those funds on the ground.
Thank you, Tim.
So moving on from Package 307, which was the State Invasive Species Coordinator, Package 309 was a package that we had initially requested, and after further work with the nursery industry, decided that wasn't such a good idea after all, so we're requesting to withdraw that package. Package 310, our package dealing with P. remorum, Phytophthora remorum, more fondly known as sudden oak death, the efforts that we've been undertaking in our agency to eradicate this disease in Oregon. It's been found in the wild in Curry County, and we've had a very aggressive eradication effort in partnership with the Department of Forestry. The problem is we have now also found it in host species in our nursery industry, so we're working very closely with the nursery industry and the federal government for a control program. We've received federal funds up to this point in time for that effort. We have received notice from the federal government that those funds will not be ongoing, and we need to prepare to transition to the nursery industry funding this program itself, which they are going to do. So this package, in essence, moves some of the federal funds out and begins establishing the fee revenue source from the nursery industry to continue our work with P. remorum.
It's kind of interesting in the sense that in this particular case you're continuing it because of the lack of funds, and you need to continue it, and utilizing other funds which the industry is coming forward with. And we have no similar policy option package in forestry right now, mm-hmm. because the request, well, there was never a request, to be honest. but there's no other funds immediately available, and the request is for general funds.
Mr. Chair, obviously I don't speak for the Department of Forestry, but I think part of the issue is the work that we do with the nursery industry. It is a direct benefit to the nursery industry. It maintains their viability and maintains their export market. For Pibromorm that is in the wild, there isn't a logical best source to tap into to fund that. A lot of people would make the argument this is our natural resource base and that these are the kinds of things that the public should be paying for.
You couldn't, as you're indicating, have the immediate impact, but if you had a problem in the nursery industry, it might affect immediately your ability to export product.
That's correct.
So.
Okay.
Yes.
Just a question, and perhaps you can answer it. But didn't the sudden oak show up in the federal forest also, and the feds were kind of funding their own program on their...
So far, I don't believe it's they've identified in the federal forest. But that is the concern, is that it will spread to the federal forest.
Mr. Chair, Representative Garrard, I'm not exactly sure the ownership of the forest in Curry County. My guess is it's probably a mix, because I know we have done eradication work on private property down there. The feds are involved in that effort. It is truly a state-federal cooperative control and eradication work.
My understanding from our discussions here is that they were getting assistance from federal resources, not as much federal dollars, but in terms of on the local level, and that it was actually private forests that were involved, plus I believe one state park that is actually
that's
involved.
Right. I think that's correct.
So.
Okay. Moving on, Package 312, which we've touched on a little bit, it's an enhancement of our weed grant program, would allocate an additional $1.2 million in ballot Measure 66 lottery dollars. We estimate the current program is, for this biennium, is $1.5 million, so it's close to a doubling of the grant program. We estimate that we could do an additional approximately 40 projects on the ground for weed eradication efforts. And also is requesting the one FTE that would be a project manager, monitor, implementation, tracking, all that good stuff. The next package, package 400, is the fourth of our four fee increase packages. This is in our shipping point program, which is the program that does all of the quality grading, sampling for seeds, tree nuts, fresh fruits, vegetables, etc. This is the program that also does the audit work for good agricultural practices, good handling practices on a fee-for-service basis. And I'm going to have Lisa explain to you this fee dynamic. It's a little bit different than some of our other programs, so I'll turn it over to Lisa.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, this program has statutory authority to and is required to cover the cost of the program as well as in administration. It has no general fund in the program, so it's fully fee for service. The fees are set either in administrative rule, in an hourly rate, or a 100-weight fee for different commodities, depending on the commodity type, or by contract with the individual packers to recover the fully loaded costs of delivering those services. And so this package ultimately raises the dollars for what we're raising through those three mechanisms of covering the costs. The program has undergone a great deal of change in about the last 6 to 8 years, from going from a program where we had inspectors in the facilities all of the time to a more audit-based program. And with that, there have been changes in the responsibilities for the staff. This package also reflects a reclassing of staff and a downsizing of the numbers and right-sizing of the program.
And, Madam Chair, members of the committee, we do have an error on this page. The positions are 13. The FTE is 6.13. It's not 13 FTE. It's 6.13 FTE. But would raise 1.153,093 and other funds. Okay. Moving on then, we've covered package 401. Moving on to package 402. The Oregon Sustainable Agriculture Package, of which there are two components. I think many of you have heard about this package. The first component is two FTE that would be Department of Ag FTE, and these would be the folks that would really focus on providing the technical assistance to the industry. The blueberry example that I gave for Representative Girard and his blueberries, and I understand now that he's expanding into cherries, so it's just gotten a whole lot more complicated for him, and he really needs our help.
Competition for cherries.
Yeah. So, and basically it's kind of a two-pronged technical assistance resource. One person would be more devoted to the producer and helping them understand what certification opportunities are that are out there and what they're, how they're doing in terms of their practices and documentation. Documentation is a big deal in the certification world. And the second position would really work on the marketing and retail end. Based on what we've heard from folks in the certification world, this is a real gap of need. Understanding once you are certified, how to take advantage of that and really work it through the market, as well as trying to work in the marketplace, for example, with retailers, a Safeway and a Fred Meyer and an Albertsons, and trying not to have three distinctly different certification programs from each of those retailers. If there's some way we can coordinate with them and have kind of a baseline certification program, it would make it a lot easier for producers. So that would be what the two FTE that we are requesting would focus on. The second component of this package is fondly known as OSARC, the Oregon Sustainable Agricultural Resources Center. This was an effort that was started with an Oregon Solutions project. It has multiple players in the public, private, and nonprofit sectors that have come together. And OSARC would really, I use the analogy of the Invasive Species Council, if you will, Representative Dingfelder. OSARC would be the kind of the overreaching umbrella organization, a clearinghouse for landowners, whether it's producers or others, that want some kind of certification assistance. So there could be things like wildlife work that could be done. So you could pull in ODF&W resources or defenders of wildlife. So Representative Girard could come to OSARC and say, I want to be certified. What are some resources that are out there that can help me? And OSARC, really, their role is to serve as a clearinghouse to say, well, you ought to touch base with this person, and we are going to kind of hold your hand and walk you through that process and make it work for you. So that's the notion behind OSARC. This would be three positions. It would be attached to the Department of Agriculture, housed at the Food Innovation Center, but working very closely with Oregon State University and then all of the other partners that have signed on to OSARC. We're identifying three positions, a project manager, support person, and then a really kind of a internet, web-based marketing, material development kind of a person. And then we have included $200,000 in this package that would basically purchase services that were identified as needed. So let's say we needed something from Defenders. They didn't have it readily available. OSARC may choose to contract with Defenders to provide a certain particular service to OSARC. So that is, in a very quick briefing, the kind of the big picture idea behind Package 402, both components, Component 1 and Component 2. Our staff would obviously link into OSARC and be a resource available to it. Questions? Moving on, that is it for our official packages. A couple things that I wanted to highlight. First of all, in the governor's recommended budget in the housing agency was staffing, the creation of a food policy council and staffing for a food policy council. Representative Clem can speak to this better than I can. When the bill was up in the House committee, there was a work group appointed, brought many of the players together, and basically what the agreement was out of the work group is that 1.5 of the FTE in the housing package would be moved to the Department of Agriculture, and we would be the lead staff for the Food Policy Council. So I just wanted to make sure that was on somebody's list somewhere. And then secondly, I just wanted to identify another package that we've also worked on. This is not in the governor's recommended budget. Representative Clem is leading the effort on a farm-to-school package that, as a component of that, would establish a position in the Department of Agriculture to work on this farm-to-school effort. So with that, that's our packages.
Perfect timing.
If you have any questions, Mr. Chair, sorry. Mr. Chance.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Katie, the full Ways and Means Committee has been just concluded going around the state and conducting hearings. And just a comment, Mr. Chair, that the 4-H program is very much alive, thriving. We had a lot of folks show up and speak to us on the benefits. And again, being a former commissioner in Klamath, this is probably the best youth program we have in this state. So I congratulate your agency on continuing the fine standards that the 4-H program has in the state.
Mr. Chair, Representative Garrard, I'd love to take credit for it, but 4-H is funded through Oregon State University. Go Beavers, our partner agency, through Extension. But I would echo your comments. The 4-H program has been incredible, and it really pulls in youth not only from agricultural backgrounds, but a lot of urban folks are involved, and it's a great place for those two to come together. And I just echo your sentiments about 4-H.
Representative Clem.
I actually raised a question I've been curious about for a while. I know at least one session in the last decade, the statewide services budget actually came through this subcommittee instead of education, but now it's in education. I wondered, you know, if that is more traditional to do it through education and that was a fluke the one time, or if there was a big decision made, you know, at some point to shift it away from the way it had been being done.
Well, I think, actually, I don't know how long the tradition goes back, but as long as I can remember, it's actually been in education. Although some people in education have wanted the DSL budget because because of its relationship to the Common School Fund. I think those things are always interesting.
I think it was the 99 session that came through here, actually.
The other thing, I think Representative Garrard kind of understated the amount of testimony, because I think at least three of our hearings, the 4-H testimony was like 20% of our testimony. and somebody really turned them out.
I can't take credit for that either, Mr. Chair. Great idea.
But I think, and to some extent, I think it was very good, but in some extent, to the average person there, they might perceive that the Extension Service is just 4-H and Master Gardeners, because that's who largely came.
And I might just reiterate, Mr. Chair, the comments that I made when we were down on campus, I guess, was it just last week, whenever it was, the importance of the experiment station extension work, the research that's done at OSU, and the benefit it has for the industry as a whole and our ability to compete in a global marketplace. So while I'm not a beaver, I kind of feel like one sometimes. Mr. Chair, I wasn't going to go through any more detail. I didn't know if you wanted us to go quickly through our legislation.
Maybe it would be good to point out some things of particular interest, and a few of those items that you have may end up coming to this committee. So
that's correct. That's under tab 6. The four pieces of legislation that are House bills actually were our non-controversial bills. We saved all of the good stuff for Senator Vakian's committee, and I know he has appreciated that immensely.
Pleasure.
I know, but you're getting these four House bills have made, well, one's actually gone through the Senate, but the other three are coming your way. On the Senate side, Senate Bill 234, Regulation of Biopharmaceutical Crops, just moved out of the Senate committee. This is an effort that we undertook through the interim to try to find kind of a right way to go about dealing with this emotional issue of the potential of growing biopharmaceuticals in agricultural products. Senate Bill 239, has not had a hearing yet. We're waiting to see whether it does or not. This is what I had spoken to in terms of clearly providing an exemption from Measure 37 around our authorities with quarantines, embargoes, control districts, right to farm.
Do you know to which committee it was assigned?
That's in Senator Vakian's committee. Senate Bill 236, this was our fee increase for the livestock program, and that has moved through the Senate. Actually, surprisingly not controversial. Senate Bill 238, the weights and measures fee increase, is up Tuesday afternoon, we believe.
Today.
Oh, my goodness. It's up today. And that, again, we think it's going to be fine. Kind of would. Senate Bill 235 has been the real fun one, and that's probably all I should say on that one. And Senate Bill 237.
Nobody knows what you're talking about.
I know. Senate Bill 237, the pesticides fee increase has moved out of committee. Then I mentioned the Food Policy Council bill, which I believe is down here somewhere now, maybe.
Send it down here out of committee.
And the farm just
in the
magic box.
Yeah, it's in the.
Holding pen is a good.
It's in the lock box.
There you go.
Is what it's.
In the farm to school.
The co-chair's lock box.
The farm to school package as well is down here now, I believe. So. I think that's everything, Paul, that I can
think of. Yep, so.
With that, Mr. Chair, unless there are other questions or any other things that you want me to go over, I'm done.
Okay. Any additional questions from the committee? If not, we will have public testimony tomorrow. We will also, we might want to call around the members of the committee. We will have a work session first thing on DLCD in the morning.
Tomorrow morning, first thing.
Mr. Chair, Paul, do you want us to go through Senate Bill 5003, the fee ratification bill, today?
Okay, we can go back to that in just a moment.
Turn that over to
but
Lisa
just to let you know that the DLCD budget will be here for work session. I will not be here on Thursday, and you will have three work sessions. Well, you will have three hearings and possible work sessions on Thursday on fee-related bills. Okay, you were going to go through the fee ratification. Yes. Please proceed.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'll quickly run you through our fee ratification bill, and if you have questions, please feel free to stop me. The first fee we are asking to have ratified is our seed export testing fees. We've taken those, this is fund neutral, taken them from an hourly cost and worked that into a per test cost. It makes it easier for the industry to bill that out when those costs can be passed on to others, and so there's a range of fees that have been adopted there. The second fee we're asking to have ratified is the reinstatement of the surcharge for the pesticide use reporting system. This was a $40 fee increase that's charged on pesticide registration fees that specifically goes to fund the pesticide use reporting system.
Mr. Chair?
Yeah.
Who's the fee? Who pays it?
Pesticide registrants. So anyone who manufactures a pesticide, they are required to register it for sale in the state if they want to sell it here. There is a fee charge for each pesticide product that the state registers for sale. The manufacturers, yes. The third fee that we are asking to have ratified is the implementation of the Nursery Emergency Fund surcharge. This was established by the 2005 legislature. It's a millage fee, and it's capped at once we get that fund to $250,000, we'll stop charging the fee, and then it can be reinstated if and when that fund is used or executed. We also instated in our brand inspection program to get us through this biennium. We've talked about the fee increase in terms of the cap increase for the future, but we instated a time and mileage fee during the interim that was allowed by statute of $25. And then finally, the last set of fees, these specifically speak to our shipping point inspection program and support the package for the shipping point inspection program. It establishes an hourly inspection fee of $60 an hour. It sets a series of fees of hundredweight fees by commodity. And then it also adopts USDA's fee and their charges for the joint program that we administer for good handling and good agricultural practices at $75 an hour. as well as an overtime fee and fees for our export certification documents.
Just so the committee is aware, this will be in one fee ratification bill. Ms. Koba, anything additional? Well, with that, we are adjourned until close public hearings. We are adjourned until tomorrow. I need everybody here at 8:30 tomorrow. We will have a work session on DLCD. We're adjourned.